The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So periodically, events happen in the world where it feels kind of odd to come here and give a talk and not somehow address it or talk about it. And so today is one of those days. And I think the events have to do with blasphemy and response in among some people in Libya and Egypt and other places to this movie or video clips that were made here in the United States that seemingly, I haven't seen it, but seemingly are pretty disparaging of Muhammad. And so people who see that as blasphemous are now been rioting, and people have been killed, and it points to many things. But one of the things it points to is how regularly religion enters into the public world in such a way that it inflames tensions that exist in our societies and our countries. And this is not the first time that something like this has happened, but it happens in many countries in many different ways, that religion can be a really hot-button issue for people. One of the virtually sacred aspects of United States culture, kind of the founding principles, has been the idea of religious freedom and religious tolerance. And so to kind of ensure for that, there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, so that the state does not impose itself, its religious values on people. But then it's one thing to have religious freedom, it's another thing for individuals who have that freedom to use it to be intolerant for other people's religious views, and or to take their own views and figure out some way to impose it on people who don't belong to that religion. One of the great stories of religious freedom or tolerance or acceptance in America is a story from the 1820s of a Baptist minister from someplace like Louisiana or Alabama who was a senator, a U.S. senator. And apparently in the mid-1820s, or before that, the U.S. Postal Service was open 7 days of the week. And so the Senate was discussing, should they close the postal service on Sunday to give people a break, right? And it's a lot to do. Maybe it was expensive to run a postal service 7 days a week. And the senator stood up in the Senate, and to me it's kind of significant, he was a Baptist minister, and he said, no, we can't do that, because Sunday being a Sabbath is a Sabbath for a particular religious group. And it would be imposing one religious group's values onto another. And we can't do that here in this country. So eventually, I guess he lost out. And part of that, him being a Baptist, isn't there just the contrast between what it means to be a Baptist today, but rather what it is, my understanding is that the Baptists were among other Christians in the time back then, where one of the really sacred aspects of their religious view was conscience, personal conscience, and that it was imperative to leave people alone to act on their own conscience. That personal conscience was a sacred thing, and you wouldn't want to somehow limit that or impose yourself on it. And even though people might have different religious views than your own, you wanted to give them that freedom of conscience to be able to choose and decide for themselves. So I thought that, to me it's a little bit inspiring, that kind of history of the United States. And then we also have in the United States a history of intolerance, lots of it, religious intolerance. And some of it is not necessarily for religion, but it's mixed up with ethnic intolerance. So for a long time Catholics were discriminated against terribly. And how much was because they're Catholic, how much because they were Italian, for example, and the Northern Europeans who dominated society in the United States thought this, the immigrant Italians coming in were not really up to standards or something. And there's been waves of people who have come to this country who weren't up to the standards or something, and then this mixed up with their religion and the criticism of their religion as part of that phenomena. So this interplay of how religion plays out in the public sphere is a very interesting one. And here, as Buddhists, as a Buddhist center, what if any role do we have in the public discourse, in the public sphere? Do we simply stay quiet and close our eyes and watch our breath and live happily ever after? Or do we somehow speak up? Do we have a role? More than a role, do we have a responsibility? Are corporate entities like churches, like IMC, are they in a sense citizens? Apparently the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, right, decided that corporations are citizens, and so you couldn't limit their campaign contributions. So are we citizens, in a sense, as an organization, as a church, that has a certain degree of responsibility for its community that we're in? And how do we step forward into the community? What would that responsibility be? And how would it be? How would it act? One of the principles that I think we have here at IMC that I like us to have, and which among other Buddhist groups that I've known, been part of, mostly here in the West, is kind of an ideal to be apolitical, so that anybody of any political persuasion could feel comfortable to come here. And if we start taking too strong political positions and only say we're going to, you know, advocate for the libertarians or something, or the Green Party or some party, and say, you know, kind of criticize everybody else, pretty soon the Democrats and Republicans are going to feel kind of like, you know, these are not my people, or I'm not comfortable here. So the idea to be apolitical, in order to be a place where people can use IMC and the teachings and practice here as an important resource for themselves. So that kind of neutrality is meant to be part of what we offer the wider world. So then we come to this issue of blasphemy. One of the interesting questions would be is where does Buddhism recognize blasphemy? And, you know, as good Buddhists, should we take up arms when something happens? Or is that kind of the style of Buddhism? And so in that regard, I think one of the... it's very interesting that kind of this issue is addressed front and center, the very beginning of the Buddhist scriptures. In a sense, Buddhist scriptures don't have a beginning like the Bible has a beginning. So it's a little bit arbitrary when you say where the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures are. But in the canon that we have, the collection of sacred books that we have, there's one book which is always listed first, one collection of texts always listed first. And within that collection, there's one text which is first, number one in that collection. So it's a big book called The Long Discourses of the Buddha. As you can see it, it's pretty heavy, hefty. And there's a first text, of course. And so that first text maybe is one that qualifies the most as the very beginning. And it begins by the Buddha with his monastic disciples wandering around India. And they come across, or they come to the camp, or they spend some time where other renunciants, other spiritual seekers of his time were also kind of wandering around. And there is a teacher of another sect and his student who somehow end up kind of walking along at the same pace or same way in the same kind of direction as the Buddha and his disciples. And so as they kind of wander kind of more or less on the same path, same road over some days, the monks, Buddhist monastics, they hear what's going on, the conversation that the other student and teacher are having. And the conversation is that the teacher is disparaging the Buddha. And the student is defending the Buddha. So these are non-Buddhists, but they're having this, you know, for many days they're having this kind of argument or conversation. Here it says, the teacher was abusing the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, while his pupil defended them. So eventually this became well known, well enough known that the Buddha met with his monastics and addressed this issue. You know, here these people are constantly disparaging us and our teachings, and you know, so what do we do? Do we, you know, quarter them, and, you know, or burn them at the stake, or you know, what should we do about these people? And so this is what the Buddha said, speaking to his disciples. If anyone should speak in disparagement of me, of the Dhamma, or of the Sangha, you should not be angry, resentful, or upset on that account. If you were to be angry or displeased at such disparagement, that would only be a hindrance to you. For if others disparage me, the Dhamma or the Sangha, and you are angry or displeased, can you recognize whether what they say is right or wrong? So it's a hindrance to be angry. If you're angry, do you have the clarity to be able to understand what is really true? And so he asks, and so the monastic disciples say, no. They give the right answer. And then Buddha continues, if others disparage me, the Dharma, or the Sangha, then you must explain what is incorrect as being incorrect, saying, that is incorrect, that is false, that is not our way, that is not found among us. But if others should speak in praise of me, of the Dhamma, or of the Sangha, you should not, on that account, be pleased, happy, or elated. If you were to be pleased, happy, or elated at such praise, that would only be a hindrance to you. If others praise me, the Dharma, or the Sangha, you should acknowledge the truth of what is true, saying, that is correct, that is right, that is our way, that is found among us. So, the first teaching of the Buddha in the first text of the Buddhist canon, that's what it says. It addresses the whole issue of religious relationship between different religious points of view, and what do we do if someone criticizes you, criticizes your religion, your religious teaching, your founder of your religion. And so here the idea is, I think, with the interpretation is you can be tolerant of it. You don't get angry. If it's angry, it's to your own detriment. And this is a point of view of Buddhism. I think a big point of view is that anger is not useful. Not necessarily that's useful for the world, but it's very unuseful for yourself. It's a hindrance for yourself. It's suffering for yourself. It creates very unfortunate conditions for you in the present and into the future. And so the idea is to figure out some way in Buddhism to not have anger dominate, and then to be wise about the anger that you do have, so you don't cause any damage to yourself or to others. And so part of what we're seeing in the world today is people who get angry. People are angry with each other, and in that anger and hostility and hate, they say things towards each other which offends their religion, and then they're being offended. Some people then get angry and get hostile in return. I don't know if it's a fair principle to talk about, but it is my impression that the bigger the issue of blasphemy is for people, religious blasphemy, the more likely they're going to also be intolerant of other people's religion. It's one thing to be upset if someone disparages your religion. It's another thing to be intolerant of someone else's. And so I think those two seem to go together. Has been my observation. So the greater intolerance of someone else, the more people are upset when their own religion is criticized. And it gets quite dramatic. I mean, I've traveled in countries where people have told me, individuals for sure, I don't want to generalize, that that they said that Buddhists should be killed because of their religious views. Because their views were so radically different from central religious views of their own religion, and it was offensive to them, or threatening to them, or just so offensive to them that somebody even have these other kinds of views. And so, you know, Buddhists should be killed. It was, you know, what I was told. Some people assume that Buddhists are kind of more peaceful types. And so, you know, that doesn't seem quite fair. But, you know, those kinds of views occur. And the idea of killing someone for their blasphemy, you know, is has a long tradition in religious circles. And I read that the last time a government in the West killed someone for blasphemy was in England in about 1669 or something, in the late 1600s. There was a young man, I think he was about 20 years old, who was executed for his blasphemy against the Christian church. And I don't know if it was the last time someone was tried in England for blasphemy, but it was a Sangha Rakshita tried for blasphemy, you know, Ellen? Do you know if Sangha Rakshita was tried for blasphemy in England? No, you don't know. I have this impression that Sangha Rakshita in 1977 was kind of tried for blasphemy. There's a whole thing about him and in England, so... Or he was commenting on someone else being tried in England in 1977. The English teacher, Buddhist teacher, governments will try people for blasphemy, and whether they're trying to protect the religious freedom of their people is maybe, you know. So in Indonesia recently, there was a thing in the news about the courts in Indonesia defending Buddhism because someone they thought Buddhism was being people were doing kind of a blasphemous thing for Buddhists against Buddhism, and that was someone in Indonesia had a bar named Buddha Bar, and just to have a bar with that name was kind of blasphemous, and so they had to close down. That happened very recently. And so, you know, it's most of Indonesia is Muslim, but here they're protecting, you know, so the government has that view. In Sri Lanka as well, which is a Buddhist country, the government has laws against blasphemy. Thailand has very strong laws against blasphemy. Any kind of, anything really, it's really offensive to monks, monastics, you can go into jail. No one thought I was being blasphemous, but when the first time I was, the second time I was in Bangkok living at a temple, back then, the way you bathed in the middle of downtown Bangkok was you'd go outside in the courtyard of the monastery, and they had running water or a fountain or something, and you had a little bucket or small kind of bowl that you'd hold, and you'd put the bowl under the water, and then you would fill the bowl with water, and you'd dump it over your head. And so that's how you'd shower, how you'd clean in public. And so the question was, you know, I didn't know that when I went there, so the question, what do you wear when you have a shower like that? And so, you know, it wasn't going to be my underwear, and I didn't have a bathing suit, and I wasn't going to be naked, and the monastery said, what do you do? So someone in the monastery, I don't know, I don't remember anymore, but I think it was a Western monk or someone, gave me an underskirt of one of the monks, and that's what the monks do. They have these underskirts that go down to the ankles almost, and so you're naked except for the skirt that you wear, and so with that you dump water and you clean yourself. So I was given this thing to wear, and as soon as I started wearing it and taking a shower, some other monk yelled at me for being disrespectful. Like this was actually, say, there's laws in Thailand against impersonating a monk, and this was really a bad thing to do, and you can go to jail for doing this. So I didn't do that again. So there are these. So governments make laws, but how much they come from the government and how much they come from the, you know, religious, ecclesiastical people, I don't know. I grew up in Buddhism with, you know, my early years of Buddhism in Zen. And there I was, you know, there was a wonderfully irreverent, dramatically irreverent, you know, stories that they would tell themselves. So, you know, like, you know, there's, you know, what do you do when you meet the Buddha? And the answer is, you kill the Buddha. Whew! And so, you know, I don't think they meant it literally, but the idea was your idealization of the Buddha, kind of projecting onto the Buddha your ideals just got in the way of your freedom here and now. And so, please, you know, you should cut that down. Or another question, I think it's one of the cases in a famous collection of koans, practice kind of texts with a little Zen people practice with and ponder, and they're called the Gateless Gate, Mumon Khan. Someone asks, what is Buddha? And that's a good question. Who's the Buddha? What's the Buddha? And probably, what was probably one of the most irreverent answers that could have been given, he said the answer was a shit-wiping stick. So they didn't have toilet paper back then, but they had these sticks they would use for the same purpose. And so, you know, that's a, you know. So I grew up with those stories coming out of Asian Buddhism. So the idea that we're concerned about blasphemy and all that is not, I didn't grow up with that idea. I believe because of this tremendous emphasis that we put on practice and monitoring ourselves, watching ourselves, and seeing what our reactions are, and realizing that things like anger are harmful, and realizing that harming other people is harmful for them, that not wanting to do that out of compassion and care, that the idea of being intolerant when people are blasphemous against us is not really in the spirit of what Buddhism is about, as this text was that I pointed to. The idea is to kind of hold it widely in some big way. But at the same time, it's not to accept it and just walk away and be silent, because the Buddha says that don't be angry, try to understand what people are saying, and if what they're saying is not accurate, then speak up. And tell them what you think is true. What if they don't like it? That's maybe not your responsibility. You try to explain yourself the best you can. So you're not being a pushover and just ignoring it, but it's also not being assertive and kind of trying to force yourself on someone. So how do you know what is true then? So if you're supposed to know what's true, how do you know what's true? And there are many levels of that for Buddhists. But I think one of the most interesting ones for many of us in terms of this question of religious intolerance is a famous text called the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha taught a group of people who were known as the Kalamas. And the Kalamas were also concerned a little bit about this issue of people disparaging each other, because people have been doing this for thousands of years, disparaging each other for their religious beliefs. It's not like a new thing that we just figured out how to do. So the Buddha comes to the territory of the Kalamas, and so they go to the Buddha, and they exchange cordial greetings, and then they say to the Buddha, they ask him, there are a lot of ascetics, spiritual seekers, practitioners, and Brahmins who come here. And they explain and elucidate their doctrines. And they disparage, debunk, and revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come here, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but they also disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. For us, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speaks truth and which speaks falsehood. So that's reasonable. You have a spiritual supermarket like they have in the modern world. Lots and lots of different options. Lots of people making claims about what's religiously true, and lots of people, and some people kind of then criticizing others, saying their religious views are not accurate, are not right or false. And in response, the Buddha says, first he says, it is fitting, it is right, it's appropriate for you to be perplexed. It is appropriate for you to have doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. So I kind of like this. This whole issue of religion and truth and who has the right one and not right one is perplexing. Maybe once we start entering into religious dialogue, trying to find out the truth, maybe it's almost impossible to find our way out, because the basis upon, the assumptions people are making their claims on are so different from each other. Worldviews are so different. It's very hard to sort through it sometimes, and even though you're talking about the same thing. And then the Buddha says this. This is kind of, for some people, for some individuals, this what he says next is taken to be one of the, especially in some Western Buddhists, taken to be kind of like one of the most important statements the Buddha makes. So much so that I know one Western teacher, Yvonne Rand, who's been one of the senior Buddhist teachers here in the West, who's been through a lot of the challenging things that Buddhist communities can be involved in, said this: what I'm about to read to you should be tattooed on the inside of every Buddhist's eyelids. I think, meaning, you know, that this is something that people should really, you know, be reminded of regularly. So, in response to the Kalamas, and they're asking, you know, which of these teachers has the truth? The Buddha does not answer their question. So he doesn't get pulled in to the question of deciding who has the truth and who doesn't. And this is a strategy the Buddha does repeatedly in these old texts. Someone comes to him and asks, you know, who has the truth in all these different religious traditions of the time? And he declines to say that. But he always says something. What he says is he offers some principles by which people can then, you know, maybe find their own way. But here the principle is, or the idea is, do not rely on oral tradition. And there were no books back then, so you can almost say don't rely on sacred texts. Do not rely on oral tradition by lineage of teaching, by the particular teaching lineage that it comes to you by hearsay, just because you've heard it, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by personal reflection, by acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, and because you think the ascetic is our teacher. So he gives 10 criteria. And among those 10 criteria, what's interesting is that these are often the sources of authority for most religions, among them. People who are involved in religions are often looking for something which can be authoritative. They know this is the truth. And they can stand by it, we can defend it, and if you take our texts that have this and you burn it, then you're in trouble. And so, you know, the paradox is that here's a Buddhist text, I'm quoting from a Buddhist text, right? And that says, don't go by teachings, don't go by texts, you know, and don't go because you, the seeming competence of a speaker. So I don't know what you're thinking, but but there is a kind of irony in this, right? What's going on here? So that's interesting. So don't go by all these things. You don't go by the source. So what can you go by? Sometimes in popular kind of West, people explain the next part I'm going to read to you as go by your own experience. But that's too naive, because personal experience is it's such a vague term, and it's so vaguely interpreted, and it can be interpreted to mean whatever, you know, that. Buddhism has a sophisticated analysis of what constitutes experience, because it's too easy to have personal experience to be not really personal experience, but to be interpretations of experience. And interpretation is influenced by all kinds of conditions and viewpoints and things. So you have to be very careful not to say it's my experience when it's an interpretation. So this is what the Buddha says. But when you know for yourself, so he does say when you know for yourself, but the following things is what you're supposed to know for yourself, not just you know for yourself anything at all. And I think one of the, for me, very trying statements that I've heard in some circles in California is a statement, this is my truth. And as soon as someone says, this is my truth, it's time to stop the conversation. Because there's no there's no possibility for a conversation, I think. My truth, what's that mean? And but when you know for yourself the following, these things are unskillful. These things are blamable. These things are censored by the wise. These things, if undertaken in practice, lead to harm and suffering. Of these things, you should abandon them. So here the criteria, primary criteria, and what you can experience for yourself, ultimately in Buddhism, is what brings you harm. When you undertake and do these things, they lead to harm and to suffering. And this is the one half of the really important criteria in Buddhism, where we learn to rely on ourselves. We learn to use mindfulness to understand and read and recognize what it is that we do that causes us suffering and harm. So, in a sense, the scriptures of Buddhists, so this kind of Buddhist here, the real scriptures is yourself, is your heart, your mind, and how you learn to read it yourself, and this is how you read it, by learning to recognize, if I do this, this brings me harm. If I do this, this brings me suffering. So then the Buddha goes on, and he... but also you should go on the following. You should know for yourself, these things are skillful, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness. Then you should engage in them. So this is the other half. So this, you know, you read this scripture of, you know, in your heart, in your mind, to learn to recognize and become wise and become adept and become nuanced in recognizing the activity that you do that either causes suffering or causes happiness. And if it causes suffering, then the idea is to not engage in it, to abandon it. And if it causes happiness, then you're encouraged to engage in it. To make it clear what he means to these Kalamas, he asks them a series of questions. He asks them, what do you think, Kalamas? When greed, hatred, and delusion arise in a person, is this for his welfare or harm? And the Kalamas, being good, wise people, or at least participating in this literary fiction, if it was just a writing someone made up, say, for his harm. So if someone is acting on greed, hate, and delusion, the recognition, at least the Buddhist point of view, is that if you're acting on greed, hate, and delusion, it harms the person who has those feelings. And in the degree to which we want to become free of this inner harm, then we have to let go of that. And then he goes through a number of things, and he describes this more, and describing things you could do, and he asks if it's harmful or not, and they say harmful. And then he goes on and says, this translation says, when non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion arise in a person, is it for that person's welfare or harm? And the Kalamas say, it's for the person's welfare. The word non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion is an accurate translation of the Pali, except that in Pali, the ancient language, the negative of a word like this has a very strong association with a positive quality. So it's not simply the absence, but actually contains the positive quality. So some translators have translated this non-greed as generosity, non-hatred as love or loving-kindness, and non-delusion as wisdom. So it could be read, when generosity, love, and wisdom arise in a person, is it for that person's welfare or harm? And the Kalamas say it's for the person's welfare. And so it's recognizing particular states of mind and learning to have the ability to recognize these states of mind in yourself and then being able to see or recognize, are these states of mind harmful or beneficial? That this is the scripture for us. That becomes the key thing. Look at that. And if that's the primary reference through which a person engages in Buddhist practice, then if someone criticizes or disparages your Buddhism, you're poised and ready to recognize how your mind responds. And if it responds with anger, hostility, or greed in some way, you're poised to recognize that and recognize that this is not beneficial for you, it's harmful for you. And you have the healthy ability, in a healthy way, to abandon that, to let go of it. If what arises in your mind is generosity, kindness, or wisdom, you're poised to recognize that when it occurs. And so when someone then criticizes you and that's your response, you know how to respond. You know, let me act on generosity. And one of the generous ways to act is, in the right circumstances, is not to be critical, to make space for someone and say, oh, that's interesting. Maybe even say, can you tell me more? And but maybe you'll tell me more why you feel that way, why you think that way. But maybe if I allow you to do that, will you allow me to explain how it is for me and how I see it, and maybe it's different? And so there can be a dialogue, perhaps, with an open, generous heart, not one that closes down or becomes hostile in return. So it can be seen as a movement of generosity or of kindness to the person. I've seen, my impression, I don't have a good statistical evidence for this, but it's been my impression that the more hostile a person is, the more useful it is to meet them with appropriate kind of kindness. Now, if kindness is too sweet and saccharine-like, you're in trouble. But there's an appropriate way of meeting people with compassion and kindness, and make space for them. Make space for them in a certain way to let them be angry and hateful, so that something can begin to soften and relax. So the story I've told many times here, I apologize if it's too much, but I think it's an inspiring story of a woman who came to a retreat with me many years ago, told me the story of how she was a white woman, how she went to the South in the 1960s to be part of the civil rights protests. And she stood with a group of people protesting for civil rights on a street corner. And and there was a lot of intolerance and bigotry back then. And so they were there protesting. And she said a group of, she called them rednecks, came in a pickup truck, jumped out of the pickup truck, and started beating them up. And this was a time, one of the golden ages of nonviolent protesting, civil disobedience in the United States. So I don't know if they'd been trained, but they knew not to respond with violence. And so they were beat up. The next day, they went out to the same street corner and stood in protest again. And she told me that the next day, the same people came in a pickup truck, jumped out, and beat them up again. You know, probably wasn't that bad, the beating up, but they can come back the next day. But still. So, and then they went back a third day to stand in the same place. The same man jumped out of the pickup truck, had his fist above her, ready to hit her, and their eyes met, and he looked into her eyes, and he said to her, "What are you doing?" And with that, they had started having a conversation. And that third day, she wasn't beat up, but she entered into dialogue with this person. I don't know the outcome of the dialogue, but I see that as a tremendously generous act on the part of the person who got beat up. How many people have the ability to offer that kind of generosity to someone? The completely ordinary human response is certainly defend oneself, and defend oneself by fighting back or running away or not doing that again. And there have been great examples of people who have changed society, whole countries, by taking a very different approach to being attacked. So I think that the Buddhist approach, I hope it's the Buddhist approach to Buddhists being blasphemized against. Can you say that in English? What? Blasphemed against is first and foremost is not to get angry And then we have to decide what to do after that, whether to speak up or participate or just educate people if we can, or, you know, or offer them tea, or I don't know what it would be. But you know, not to meet it with anger. But at the same time, I think the idea of speaking up and speaking the truth, I extend to mean not just roll over and disappear, but to hold your ground. And, you know, the great thing about, we don't run away, we don't attack, but we look the other person who's attacking us, we look them in the eyes. We don't run away, we don't attack, but we hold the ground, we look them in their eyes, and we try to engage, we try to meet them, and see if in the meeting of human beings. And this idea of looking at our greed, looking at our generosity, looking at our heart's hate, and looking at kindness, looking at delusion, looking at wisdom, these are the qualities of the heart that we all share. And so our ability to recognize this in ourselves, in a quiet, dedicated way, I hope it's a way of helping us meet the hearts of other people so there can be a heartfelt connection between people as opposed to trying to find meeting through the complexity of religious doctrines, whether it's Buddhist or something else. And my wish for Buddhism is that, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit arrogant, I apologize, but my wish for Buddhism is that Buddhism itself is in a certain kind of way a-religious, just like IMC is apolitical, so that Buddhism can kind of be the mediator in this huge, complicated world of inter-religious dialogue, that we don't take a stand for or against other religions, but we offer presence, mindfulness, compassion, neutrality, and certain about these kinds of issues, because a lot of these religious issues that people are attached to are not that important for Buddhists. So we don't have to get caught up, but we can offer space, be the mediators for it, so that we can all live together more peacefully. So that's my talk. I hope that was okay. I hope I didn't offend any religion in saying it. So thank you.